Good afternoon. We're ready to hear argument in Seinfeld versus Verizon. You ready to proceed?
We are, Your Honor.
Mr. Goldberg?
Good morning, Your Honors. It's my pleasure to present my co-counsel in this case, Irving Bazar, from the firm of Ballin, Stoll, Bader, and Naylor, and he will be presenting argument on behalf of plaintiff.
Welcome. And then when I start the clock, your time will count down. When you get to the yellow light, you'll be using the time you reserve. And you're welcome to use it, but we're not going to give you any more.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. We submit that the decision of the Chancery Court below should be reversed. This Court has previously stated that Section 220 can be used as an information-gathering tool in the derivative context. It has also held that it is a proper purpose to use Section 220 to investigate possible mismanagement. And I underscore the word possible, as this Court did in that decision. And to establish the proper purpose, this Court has also held you didn't have to prove that there was some mismanagement, only that to show by documents, evidence, logic, or otherwise, that the possibility existed and you had a credible purpose. We submit that we met that standard below. We took our information from all of the public documents filed by Verizon, and this is what it showed. Verizon resulted from a merger of Bell Atlantic with GTE. As a result of that merger, it wound up with three officials. Each had different titles, but all together performed the duties of a chief executive officer. They all had employment contracts. Messrs. Seidenberg and Babio from Bell Atlantic had their contracts expire in June and November of 2000, and they were amended accordingly. Lee, coming from GTE, had his contract expire in December, and it was renewed in December. Under the amendments, now, by the way, under the original contracts and the amended contracts, there was no provision for option grants. Very limited provisions for options. And as a result of amendments, they were permitted to participate in long-term bonus option plans, and as a result, received in the 3 years, 2000, 2001, and 2002, total compensation of $205 million. Now, if one executive officer got that, and this Court has said in the Eisner case way back that $140 million is pushing the envelope, we submit that.
Well, wait a second. This is $205 million over 3 years, isn't it?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. But it is basically the bulk of which came on option grants.
And right. But what I'm trying to understand is, are you saying that the amount that these three so-called CEOs were paid was so excessive as to in and of itself raise a reasonable suspicion of mismanagement?
Yes, that's
okay.
What we do say that.
Okay, well, wait a second. If that is the position you're taking, then what have you put into evidence to demonstrate that a total of $205 million over 3 years, roughly $70 million a year for the top officers of this company, is way out of line with what other CEOs of similar size companies make, or anything else that would show that that number should raise a suspicion of wrongdoing?
We did not, were unable to produce a comparable evidence like that, Your Honor, because that requires a demonstration of evidence. We submit that when the compensation seems to be large, based principally on option grants, which they get as a result of amendments to contracts.
Okay, but let me stop you again. I'm still having trouble with the large part of it. And again, I'm not saying that $70 million a year is not an enormous amount for somebody to be paid, but my general sense is that CEOs frequently are being paid such enormous amounts of money, and if that's correct, then what is it about this arrangement that is enough to raise a suspicion of wrongdoing?
The answer we would submit, Your Honor, that in the area of compensation, it is time that public shareholders, the plaintiff in this case is a longtime shareholder of Verizon, owns more than 4,000 shares is entitled to find out what. We're not saying the board did anything wrong. We're not saying that they didn't do whatever they were supposed to do, whether they had experts or comparisons or whatever. The limited review we seek is predicated on the idea that we should try to find out what led them to give these people all these bonus arrangements when their original employment contracts didn't provide for that at all.
Well, and I understand that a stockholder might be curious about that, but as I understand the law under Section 220, you have to have some basis, some credible basis to believe that there's been mismanagement. And that's what I'm asking you for you to tell me what that is.
There's nothing more than the amounts and the amendments of the contract, Your Honor. We valued the option grants simply using, we didn't use any economic theories, binomial theories, or whatever. We took the variables that Verizon uses itself to value the option grants. And we multiplied them out by mathematics. We didn't do it. We got someone to spend 15 minutes to multiply it out.
Okay.
That was our so-called expert. And I would submit to Your Honor that when you have these kinds of amendments, when you have this kind of option grants being given to them, when the original employment contracts didn't provide for that at all, that it ought to at least allow the shareholder, through logic, to suggest that maybe the insiders, the officers who are getting these benefits, were maybe doing something, and perhaps if you've looked at what the company did and wasn't doing all that great, why should they get all this kind of compensation? Let us see if the board did something wrong. If, in fact, the board did cross every T, dot every I, do what it was supposed to do, we're gone. 220 is not the derivative litigation. What it is an information gathering context to enable public shareholders to find out what's wrong. You cannot expect...
So where would you draw the threshold? How many millions of dollars does it take to cross this line to have this right of inspection?
I don't know that there is a flat number. Many, many years ago, Judge Augustus Hand in the Second Circuit back in the 30s suggested that anyone getting more than a million, no one should get more than $1 million. I do not argue that proposition. I don't know that there can be a flat amount that one can get, that you can say, well, if it gets more than that, we ought to look at it. I think the idea should be that if you amend contracts and you allow officers to get what seems to be an excessive amount of compensation on the face of it at the moment they get it, well, maybe the board ought to make itself transparent and allow the public shareholder to go and look and see on a very limited review, what did you look at? Did you consult experts? Did they give you a report? Can we see the report? And that's the end of this. If you require us to prove by evidence or corroboration, as it were, we're never going to be. No public shareholder can do that unless you have a whistleblower.
No, wait a second. I may not fully understand the situation here, so please correct me if I'm wrong. But couldn't you have somebody, admittedly it might take some time and effort to dig through the paperwork, but couldn't you have somebody look at other companies and see what proportion of the top executive salaries are in cash and what proportion are in stock options or other grants, and then make some sort of evaluation that says, oh, Verizon is giving enormous stock options as compared with these 10 other companies. That in itself is suspicious. Therefore, we want to look at it. I mean, there are ways of getting that kind of information, aren't there?
That could be a way of doing that. The problem is, however, there is no way to compare telecommunications companies with each other. They each have a different grasp of the market, a different share of the market. They offer different kinds of products. They have a different way of doing business. So it may be totally unfair in the first instance to be able to say, let's compare Verizon with Acme, whatever.
Because couldn't you find a good comparison if that's what you're looking for?
The difficulty with that is then, Your Honor, you'll require us to get into a battle of experts. We have our expert will say he compared with ABC. Mr. Welsh will have his expert will say, no, you compare it to CDE and look in the, and where are we?
But at least at that point, you've got something that you've presented to the trial court that says, we have a credible basis for being suspicious here because our expert or whoever has demonstrated that the numbers here are out of whack.
The difficulty with that is, in part, Your Honor, as I say, there's no way to compare the companies one with the other. Secondly, the contracts were amended to enable these executives to get what we regard as extraordinary compensation. And we would submit that if you compare that to the stock prices of Verizon, you would see that while they're getting this, the price is going down. I don't know if that's a valid comparison, but I would submit that public shareholders should be allowed to see, using 220, to see if compensation is a valid, did the board cross every T and dot every I, to require us to get some kind of corroboration. Indeed, Your Honor, let me step back. In the Walt Disney case, which this court considered some years back, all the plaintiffs had initially when the case was sent back to the Chancery Court for the court to consider the question of whether a demand futility in terms of business waste was properly alleged, the court suggested Section 220. All the plaintiffs had at that time were newspaper accounts. There was no way to compare Walt Disney with six other executive officers or whatever. Nonetheless, we submit when you get to this murky area of compensation, we should be permitted to have some opportunity just to see whether to cross every T and dot every I. The Chancery Court required us, to, in effect, to prove wrongdoing. Said we didn't have a factual basis for support. We even criticized the use of our expert, who all he did was perform a mathematical function that my partner couldn't do. That's all. And he also adverted to the fact that the options that were granted are now underwater. Well, you measure compensation at the time it's given, and everyone knows in finance, options can, just as they fall in value, can increase in value over time. That's why the options are given over a period of time. And so the fact that it is now underwater doesn't mean that it will always be underwater. On the contrary, they will increase in value, presumably, and come back to where they were granted. We submit that to require a shareholder to have corroboration short of the event itself, either by way of governmental investigation, lawsuit, or whatever, is an impossibility. You've effectively precluded 220 from being used effectively by public shareholders. So we would ask, Your Honors, basically to reverse the court below. Let us look at the very limited documents we seek. And I might add, the defendant never contested the kinds of documents we saw. We didn't seek a wide range of documents. We're very limited to the compensation that the board considered in giving these people these options.
But of the wrongdoing that you believe you have shown some basis for believing is what? Waste?
Waste, yes. In other words, giving excessive compensation, which falls into the category of waste.
Anything else?
No.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Welch.
Mr. Justice Holland. Madam Justice Berger. Mr. Justice Ridgely. May it please the court. Our client Verizon is aware that Section 220 cases are not often resolved on a summary judgment basis. This case, however, respectfully, is uniquely positioned. The plaintiff here has admitted he has nothing to add at trial, made that very clear in his affidavit, which was filed with the court below. And secondly, in his brief that he filed with this court, made very clear he has no actual evidence of any type that there was ever any wrongdoing here. Those admissions are decisive. Beyond that, and separate and apart from that, the admissions that he made in his deposition are overwhelmingly decisive, and we respectfully request that the decision of the court below be affirmed. This is, of course, a books and records demand that's under consideration by this court. The purpose is to investigate mismanagement and to investigate waste. Plaintiff has the burden of proof with respect to that, of showing that there's a credible basis to find probable or possible, and the court has used both terms, corporate wrongdoing, or a credible basis to infer that waste has occurred. No.
Simply a number ever establish that?
No, sir. No, sir. Your Honor,
about
it has
a
never
billion,
had.
2 billion.
No,
five,
sir.
5 billion.
No, sir. I don't. Well, has it ever? I apologize. I thought Your Honor was asking me about precedent. I know of no number that has ever been that appeared in a case to do that.
Would it ever?
Is it possible? I suppose it is. But the key issue, I think, for this court is that the $205 million number that they've proffered has absolutely no support in this record. I asked the plaintiff the basis for that number. We certainly couldn't figure out where it came from. I asked him in his deposition, where did those numbers come from? He put them in his affidavit, I might add. He said he didn't know. He didn't know where they came from. I said, in light of what you're telling me, about your lack of knowledge, is it possible that every one of those numbers that you put in your deposition is wrong? And he said, yes, it's a possibility. That is a possibility. So there is no record, Mr. Justice Ridgely, of any $205 million compensation. Of course, as Madam Justice Berger pointed out, the $205 was over 3 years. It also applied to three people. So it's less than $70 million a year, even as it's proffered by them, without any evidentiary support. And since it's by three people, it's actually less than $25 million a year. But I'm not even prepared to concede that, because the fact of the matter is, Mr. Justice Ridgely, there is no record any evidentiary record whatsoever of a $205 million level of compensation by these executives. And plaintiff's deposition respectfully admitted that. It is his burden. That burden is not insubstantial. This court has said that in the Security First case, and it has to be carried by a preponderance of the evidence. We know that mere disagreement with business judgment doesn't do it. We know under the Thomas and Betts case that curiosity doesn't do it, speculation doesn't do it. This court has hammered home on that point time after time after time. Any contrary rule, the court said in Security First, would just result in a fishing expedition, and this court's not going to tolerate that. Why? Because Delaware corporations have rights, too. The CM&M versus Carroll case makes that point very clearly. The focus of this case is on these three executives, three of them, and what they supposedly took by way of compensation. There have been colorful statements made about that compensation. I think the key question for this court and for the court below is, what did plaintiffs say in the deposition? What is the evidentiary record? Well, the evidentiary record, again, is decisive. There is no evidence whatsoever of mismanagement, no evidence whatsoever of waste, and no evidence whatsoever of breach of fiduciary duty. Respectfully, what did he say in his deposition? Plaintiff admitted in his deposition there was no conflict of interest on the part of any director in considering these issues. There was no independence issue with respect to the director. There was no problem with the board process. Decisive admissions on that point. There's no basis for a waste concern. I asked him, do you have any reason for suspicion that they didn't earn this money fair and square? And he said no. That there's no claim that these three CEOs, as he puts it, weren't working. More importantly, there's no basis for ever believing the point that was raised today about there being three CEOs. He acknowledged there never were three CEOs. That's in his complaint. He repeats it in his affidavit. In his deposition, he acknowledged openly there were no three CEOs. There was a point, a narrow two-year period after the merger of Bell Atlantic and GTE, where for a narrow window there were two CEOs, but he acknowledged that with respect to that, he had no quarrel with the business judgment of the board of directors of the company in maintaining these two qualified CEOs after one of the largest telecommunications mergers that had happened. Theretofore. He admitted there was no basis for concern that any of these individuals were performing the same services. He admitted that the compensation amounts in his affidavit and his complaint were not credible. He could not support them. He acknowledged that the long-term incentive plan of the corporation, of Verizon, provided for stock options. Your Honor's here today that the contracts don't provide for that. All one has to do is look at the Seidenberg contract, for example. It specifically says you can get stock options, contrary to what you were just told today. Beyond that, the long-term incentive plan approved by stockholders, and that's in the record, in January of 2001, specifically authorized stock options. He admitted that in his deposition. Contrary to what counsel told you today, that's in the deposition.
What do the SEC filings say about the compensation of these executives?
Well, Your Honor, every year, going back at least as long as I've looked at the record, the Human Resources Committee has provided a report to the stockholders in the proxy materials. And those were sent to stockholders at the time of the election of directors, and beyond that, obviously, as well, at the time that the long-term incentive plan was approved. Options are all described in there, and cash compensation, salary and benefits, and that sort of thing. We could not make that connect up with the allegations that his purported expert came up with the $205 million.
Interesting. Does the public SEC filing have a bottom-line number that your opponent says?
No, sir. No, I apologize for interrupting, Your Honor. It does have numbers in terms of compensation. It describes what those compensation numbers are. Plaintiffs have never challenged those. They've never raised those. They've never put in any evidence or raised any issue about those disclosures or their accuracy. Not a problem at all. And, of course, the stockholders knew about them when they voted to approve the long-term incentive plan. So there's no issue with respect to those disclosures that I'm aware of, Your Honor. It's all been above board, no challenge to them whatsoever. We couldn't make those numbers fit with the $205 million that plaintiff was advocating. And of course, when I asked plaintiff about that in his deposition, he couldn't do it either. Now, the only thing he points to is a purported expert computation. I'm anxious to point out to the court, as we do in our brief, that is just obliquely referenced in an affidavit of plaintiff's own counsel, of appellant's own counsel. They mentioned the name of someone who did some computations. They don't say what those computations were. They don't say what data they involved in terms of inputs. They don't say how that data was manipulated. They don't say who this expert was except by name. They don't say what his qualifications are. Indeed, there's absolutely no basis in this record for thinking that this individual who's obliquely referenced in counsel's affidavit is an expert on anything.
Well, right? Let me interrupt for a second.
Yes, Your Honor.
You seem to be making a big point of the fact that $205 million number can't be replicated, and you don't know where it came from, and the plaintiff doesn't even know where it came from, and so forth. And what I heard opposing counsel say is that it was a mathematical computation that perhaps the attorney couldn't explain because it involved using various parameters that were too complicated. But that somebody who does understand the stuff ran the numbers and came up with this $205 million. You're saying that, oh, you've looked through all the documents for the last umpteen years or whatever, and you don't see any way to come up with those numbers. What number do you come up with?
Well, Your Honor, we have not put a number in because at this point in time, what we were trying to do was understand in this summary judgment context what plaintiff's credible basis was. Now,
okay.
Now it's certainly in the record, and we put the proxy statements in. I have not added it up, neither have they. I think the important point, Madam Justice Berger, for this court, is that there's absolutely nothing in this record about any expert computations, what they were, how they were done, what was involved. But there are critical admissions made by plaintiffs in his deposition that undercut anything that he's saying.
Okay, well, here's my concern.
Sure, Your Honor.
I'm not at all sure that $205 million, even if it were an accurate number, raises the kind of suspicion that would justify a 220 demand. So let's put that aside for the
Understood,
moment.
Understood, Your Honor.
But in terms of providing a proper purpose and providing some basis for your purpose, they do have an affidavit that says, by our computations, it's $205 million. Now, their computations may be totally wrong, but isn't that something that we should be taking as a given for purposes of the present concerns?
Absolutely not, Your Honor, for a whole variety of reasons. Number one, that reference is in counsel's affidavit. Now, affidavits under Rule 56 are supposed to be made on personal knowledge. He obviously didn't have personal knowledge. He had to go to somebody else. And we don't even know who that individual was other than the name, or whether or not that individual had any qualifications whatsoever to address these issues. Beyond that, we sought discovery, didn't get any with respect to that. Now, but there are critical admissions, Your Honor, that I really...
But wait a second. So,
sure,
so let's... I understand your position on this, but let's assume for the moment that the court is willing to accept the $205 million strictly for purposes of have they put in anything that would give a basis for a 220 action. So working with the $205 million, why isn't that enough?
several reasons. Taking the undisputed factual record, in his deposition, I asked him, and let's accept that, Your Honor's premise on that. I said to him, do you have any facts which suggest that these three individuals didn't, in fact, earn fair and square all the money that they were paid for any of the years that you've identified? Answer, if I had the facts, I wouldn't be here today. I followed up by saying, what I have in mind understanding, though, is whether or not you have any factual basis for concern that they didn't earn it fair and square. Answer, no. Categorical, that he had no factual basis for concern that they didn't earn the money, whatever the number is, Your Honor, fair and square. That's what he said. Now, the other thing that I think is terribly significant, they put in this affidavit, which is, again, violates Rule 56, is unsupported, doesn't make any sense, and indeed doesn't present any facts for this court. I asked him in the deposition, how did you come up with the value of these stock options? And he responded, well, he said, I don't know if it's something to do with the market value or what. He said somebody must have valued the options on a date, a particular date, and come up with that figure. And I said, but it wasn't you? I don't believe I did. And you don't know how it was done? Answer, no. With that in mind, it's possible that every one of the numbers in this data that we're looking at is wrong, correct? And he answered yes.
Well,
the answer was possible.
Let's build on that with a hypothetical. Suppose all he has is the fact that there's base compensation plus options, and he files a 220 action, and he says, I would like to see the range of value. You know, did the board really run the numbers? And so I'd like the books and records to show that the board did that. Would that be a proper request?
That would be an improper request, Your Honor, because this court has emphasized time after time, in Security First, in Thomas and Betts, that in order to go to a corporation and make them produce books and records, you have to show a credible basis for wrongdoing. Credible means something that's believable by Your Honors and by the Court of Chancery below. There has to be evidence, and the court has made the point, has driven it home, that evidence has to be presented subject to the more probable than not standard.
Let's vary the hypothetical kind of a variation on Disney, where at least initially, before the trial, there was some concern on whether the board had run the numbers. And what he's saying is, I want to see whether they run the numbers, because if they didn't run the numbers, then I've got concerns about reelecting them.
Understood. Fair point, Your Honor. My recollection is there was a 220 demand but no 220 case in Disney. With respect to process, I want to see whether or not proper process was followed. I asked him about that. With respect to process, he told me there was no problem with board process in this case. He was not making any point of that. I said to him,
that's why I'm asking the question, just so we can understand the implications of the precedents we've had and the precedents we're establishing.
Understood, Your Honor. I think the litany of admissions that he made is really profound. With respect to process, there's no problem whatsoever. He admitted that. His testimony is he was not challenging the process. So I think the Disney hypothetical, respectfully, Mr. Justice Holland, is not something that ought to carry any precedent here. This court has spent a great deal of time.
Well, what you're saying is whatever precedent Disney established at those preliminary stages is not the fact pattern in this case.
Your Honor, absolutely. When the plaintiff testifies under oath that he has no problem with the process that was followed and indeed was making no contention to that effect, I think process comes off the table. Conflict of interest comes off the table. Independence comes off the table. Due care comes off the table. Indeed, with respect to the waste claim, that comes off the table. I asked him, do you have any basis for believing that these directors, these individuals, did not earn this money fair and square? He told me no. We've laid that testimony out in our brief.
Well, wouldn't it be a waste claim even if they did earn the money fair and square if they were excessively overpaid?
Well, Your Honor, I think the admission, I believe, is decisive. Under the Disney case, you'd have to show a transaction that was so one-sided that no person of reasonable judgment would find it acceptable. The only person we have here is the plaintiff, and he's told us that there's no problem with respect to the fact that these gentlemen earned this compensation fair and square. That's the only record Your Honors have to deal with. That was the only record that they gave to Vice Chancellor Lamb below. And his reaction to it was obviously to grant summary judgment, pointing out that they had not satisfied the Thomas and Betts standard. They hadn't satisfied Security First. There was no credible basis to believe anything was wrong with the process, the board, the independence, the care, the loyalty, or anything else.
Or the amount.
Or, Your Honor, with respect to the amount. And of course, the key thing with respect to the amount is the fact that he's acknowledged he can't even begin to support it. The affidavits that they've given Your Honors don't even begin to support it. And then he goes on to tell the court that they've earned the money. Whatever the money is, they've earned it. That's not a record that I think this court would want to adopt or respect when it comes to reversing a decision of the Court of Chancery on a matter that is as important to Delaware corporations as compensation of their executives. As Your Honor pointed out, Madam Justice Berger, even accepting their number at 205, it's over a three-year period, and of course it's three individuals. You get somewhere south of 25, I think. But again, I'm not even going to make that representation. That's just the math that they used. But add to that the plaintiff's admissions here, and again, the result of that is really powerful. Now, I think it's
I think we need to be concerned about is we have many cases that say don't file a frivolous complaint. Use the tools at hand, file a 220 action. And as you stated, everyone's concerned about the executive compensation. And as I understand your argument, we reconcile all of this by saying the predicate for a 220 action is to have a legitimate concern. And if you don't come forward with a legitimate concern, and we have a long list of ways to win a 220 action, but you haven't picked one, you just don't get it here.
Your Honor, I think I would not try to top that summary, because I believe respectfully that Your Honor said it exactly right. The key to it is this court has said we want evidence. We want a credible basis, and we want proof by a preponderance of the evidence. That is simply not here. When you look at this deposition, it is powerful. He made admission after admission after admission with respect to everything ranging from independence to process to amounts to the stock options. He even acknowledged that many of the things that Your Honors were told here today were in fact wrong. Your Honors were told today that they performed the same services. He said that they didn't in the deposition. They performed the same duties as CEO, had the same responsibilities. He acknowledged that they didn't. There was some suggestion that the long-term incentive plan was modified in order to allow stock options. Plainly false. That's just wrong because there's nothing in the record that supports that. No evidence of what section of the plan was amended, how it was amended, what was done. Absolutely nothing in the record. This case is significant for its extraordinary lack, its profound lack of any kind of a factual record for any kind of the claims that they're making, indeed including the ones that they were pressing to Your Honors today.
In terms of a legal standard, your opponent keeps referring to a possibility of wrongdoing. Is that the legal standard?
Pardon me, Your Honor?
Is possibility of wrongdoing the legal standard?
Well, in Thomas and Betts, there were two words used. What's crystal clear is there has to be a credible basis based upon evidence that will support some showing of wrongdoing. But the court used possible in the probable in the beginning of the opinion and possible later on in Mr. Justice Veazey's opinion. Thomas and Betts used the same basic standard, but the whole point was there had to be a credible basis based upon evidence. And I apologize, I see my time has run out, Your Honor. If I could finish
Please answer.
Thomas and Betts made the point that there has to be a credible basis based upon evidence by a preponderance of the evidence sufficient to support an inference of wrongdoing. Here, respectfully, it simply is not present, not even close. He fails on every single element of proof that could possibly be raised.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Mr. Welch says your client gave away his case.
Let me start, Your Honor, perhaps by going to the issue of value, the value of the options. I guess I should say, wouldn't it have been nice if Verizon had in its public filings set the value of the options, told the public shareholders, this is why we gave them options, this is what we value it at. After all, the board had to have valued them. They weren't giving out pieces of paper, yet throughout the entire proceedings, and even here, Mr. Welsh has not told you what those values are. So we would submit that $205 million, which incidentally the plaintiff in his deposition could not speak, but in the moving affidavit, and it's in the record at A91, describes where it came from, and the record shows how. It's just a mathematical computation. Now, if we had to put that into the record, I suppose we failed. But I think it's fair to say that we were right in terms of doing the variables. Now, he speaks about what my client testified to at his deposition. I think it's fair to say you have to read the entire deposition to get the full import. Yes, my client did not have direct evidence that they didn't show up for work or they did A, B, C, D. But what he did say is, I'd like to know if they did. I want to know what the board looked at. I want to know if the board ran the numbers. I want to see what the board did to justify this. After all, in this case, Your Honor, these contracts had no limits. There were no benchmarks. And this court long ago was committed to the proposition decided, I think, by Judge Seitz long, long ago in Sachs against Brady. There is a point at which equity will say the compensation is excessive. And obviously depends upon the facts. We are entitled in a summary proceeding, which is all 220 is. It's not a trial. It all it is a summary proceeding to see what the facts are. If they did their job, we're gone. That's all. Why should they be so fearful about disclosing the job? We continue to press, Your Honor, to ask that Chancery be reversed.
Thank you. Thank you both. The court appreciates your briefing and your arguments. We'll take the matter under advisement and we'll adjourn.